Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona Kay, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And my hope is that the information shared in this podcast will help you understand the strengths, differences, and challenges in your neurodiverse relationship as you move forward in life. Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I am so thrilled to be starting season 7 of the Neurodiverse Love Podcast with one of my previous co-hosts, Greg Fuqua. He has agreed to come back. And Greg and I are going to do at least 6 episodes, probably more, together. And so, Greg, welcome back to co-host the podcast with me. I'm really glad you're here.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. And I'm excited to get into it and start talking about these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those folks that have not had an opportunity to meet you, mm-hmm. I'd love it if you could share a little bit about you and the work you do so they can know a little bit about you.
Absolutely. Yeah. So my name's Greg Fuqua. I am 53 years old. I am a licensed mental health counselor in Iowa. I'm a neurodiverse couples level 2 trained counselor. I'm also an autism clinical specialist. I identify as on the spectrum. And I have been in a neurodiverse relationship for well over 30 years now. So that's kind of what I bring.
I love it. And, you know, we have learned a lot together during our conversations. And I know that our conversations have been really helpful to the audience and the listeners from all around the world. And today we're going to talk about something that I know can be a challenge for couples as they begin to understand their own neurotype and each other's neurotypes and want to support each other in different ways. And that topic is different needs for socialization and family time. So I know this is a hot button, and especially since we're coming off of the holidays, we're recording this at the beginning of February, right? So do you want to share a little bit about, as the autistic partner, maybe what you've seen in your own family, in your own relationship around that? And then I'll share a little bit about mine.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and of course, I am sort of late identified, but these patterns were present before, you know. Luckily, I think I've had a family that has, I guess, kind of understood a little bit about Greg and what I need and what I don't need. But you know, as much as I can't say I'm like a lover of the holidays or anything. But I do like connecting with people, and I, you know, and when it's within my capacity range and I have time for recovery and I have time for space for myself, and I also am considered in the process of events and expectations, you know, I think things go pretty well. So a couple things that kind of stand out to me when we would visit family was, a lot of times I would bow out of planned events. So, you know, we may be traveling to family and they have a lot of things they want to do with us. And, I'll just be like, no, I'll stay home, you know? And I know there's some maybe questioning and some disappointment around that. And of course there's some anxiety, you know, internally for me, you know, asking for that and not feeling like I can do that, or I'm part of the family in the same ways, you know. And of course, I'm sure they wonder, you know, does Greg not like us? Does he not like doing this? You know, why is he saying no to this? You know, and so the expectations and the understanding of it, I don't think was ever really there. And my family has gotten used to me and what my normal, quote unquote, is compared to theirs. And so I think there's less of that that happens now, but I'm still not completely out to my extended family. I think a few people know, but, and I think we've kind of talked about this before. Do I want to educate and explain and, you know, catch everybody up to what that means and how they don't think I fit that diagnosis and yada, yada, yada? No. But the one thing I have found that has really worked for me as in family events is having a role. And I love cooking. And it's one of my special interests or deep interests. And I'm good at it. And my brother is a trained chef. My dad was a big gourmet. And so I've been around food and foodies for a long time. And so I do a lot of the cooking, and that helps me focus, get some of my deep interest connection and connection to myself, and allows me to find a role that isn't in this open social domain all the time. Right. So I think that kind of gives a little bit of overview of, you know, probably some of the, you know, and the common dynamics and the ways, you know, I've tried to navigate family time in particular around the holidays.
Yeah, I think that's going to be really helpful to a lot of folks that are listening, because I'm going to share a little bit about my perspective in my family when I was married to my ex. And, you know, I, of course, didn't understand until our 29th year of marriage that we were a neurodiverse couple.
Right.
So the scenario would be something like my daughter and her friends might be over for dinner, and my ex might not be home yet. And when he came home, he might go into his computer room rather than coming and sitting down with us for dinner. And then I would oftentimes ask my daughter to go get her father, ask him to join us. And what I didn't realize is, number one, usually I hadn't notified him that we were going to have guests, you know. Number two, he had just spent a full day at work and needed his downtime, and that had not been communicated to me. So I didn't know that. And, you know, he needed that transition period after work. And so, you know, we weren't respecting each other's needs, and I wanted him to be involved in the meal or the get together with my daughter and her friends. So I think being aware of what both partners need when it comes to socializing and having that conversation ahead of time can be really helpful. Because one or both of them is one or both partners is going to get disappointed if you don't have that conversation, right? Or overwhelmed. And I can tell you there were many family events where we'd look around and my ex-husband was nowhere to be found. And it became a joke. And I think I've talked about this on the podcast, because I'd say, oh, he's in the bathroom. And I know he would go to the bathroom because nobody was going to bother him there. And he could be there as long as he needed to. And it was just kind of a joke. But, you know, I've heard from other couples where, you know, the autistic partner might take out their computer or their phone and disengage from conversation, right? And it might appear rude, but the fact of the matter is they are probably overstimulated and don't necessarily know how to communicate that to everybody that's at the social event. Or they may walk outside, you know, and go for a smoke, or, you know, just stand outside or go have a drink by the bar so they don't have to socialize with everybody. And if we understand what we each need, that can be a way to reduce the tension, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, there's social differences here, and I wouldn't say there's necessarily social deficits, you know?
Right.
And one of the things I often talk about with my neurodiverse couples is when you are getting ready, and to do that socializing event or that thing you're doing with your families is to actually plan and prepare beforehand. You know, there needs to be a plan. It's helpful to know what is coming, what are the expectations, and then to be able to work around that depending on how each of you feel about that. You know, what's most important? Where can I escape? Having an escape plan is
right.
You know, and knowing that and having support around that is absolutely huge. And I think there's a big difference between also, so, you know, you talk about sort of, you know, that coming home and that transition period, you know, and having a lot of autistic neurodivergence tend to be what appears to be more avoidantly attached. Mm-hmm. And so they need self-soothing time. They need time to sort of recover. They need alone time. And particularly if you're paired up with someone with a little bit more of an engaged or anxious attachment style, you're going to get into a what we call a pursuer-avoidant dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
That actually creates more and more problems, you know. So you're wanting to know what's wrong, you're wanting to connect, you're wanting to bring them out, and they are, and that's creating more and more pressure and actually creating more time for their needs and recovery and actually creating more overwhelm. And so one sort of amplifies the other. And that's very common. I see that all the time.
Yeah. And I know, you know, this would happen too in my marriage. You know, we would agree that we would be going somewhere, and it got to be a joke, you know, between my daughter and I that my ex was always late. And what I realized is I didn't understand that he needed that time alone, or that transition mm-hmm. time, or that decompression time, or there were other things that he needed to do before he could leave the house. And I would oftentimes get so upset because, you know, I don't remember us really being on time to a lot of things. And when we were trying to do something that was fun and we were going to socialize as a family or with others, and we were almost always running late,
mm-hmm.
I got very judgmental. I got very angry. It might turn into a fight on the way over right. to wherever we were going. Yep. And it wasn't pleasant. And if we had both understood what we needed, we even could have taken separate cars. And that's something that I advise to couples that feel like one person might not be able to stay for the entire time yep. of the event, right? And nowadays, you know, you could take Uber or Lyft, which is a lot easier, right?
Yep.
But there's no reason that you can't have that conversation ahead of time mm-hmm. and say, you know, I have enough spoons or I have enough bandwidth to stay for about an hour.
Right.
And I'm going to drive alone.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. And, you know, I hadn't thought about, but that kind of goes along with, I guess, the exit plan idea too, you know, is kind of working that out, you know. And, you know, the opposite dynamic actually happens for me and my wife. And my wife is an ADHDer, and so she tends to run a little bit late because she's kind of forgetting things. She's trying to gather things up, you know, we got to get ready. And for me, that creates a lot of dysregulation right away because I'm ready to go. My mind is already moving there. It's mm-hmm. already there. And then she ends up sort of keeping me in transition, which is the worst thing a lot of times you can do to an autistic person is to keep you in between things, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the opposite dynamic can also happen too. I also have to be on time. I prefer to be a little bit early. I want to take that anxiety out of the equation if I can in the social situation, you know. I want to be there when I'm expected to be, right? And I'll, you know, leave earlier if I can. But I agree that the planning and preparation together ends up being the thing that's overlooked, because the expectations or assumptions are that you guys are attuned and everybody, you know, wants this in the same kind of way. And I think that's where things kind of start going wrong. And so the planning, preparing, super important. But then I always say, you got to debrief afterwards, you know. You don't learn from experience. You learn by reflecting on experience. And I think a lot of the problems on maybe the autistic side is an unawareness of where they're at and what they need. And so to talk about it can be difficult or feel pressurized. And then we get mixed up in, okay, why is she asking me this? What are the expectations? You know, how do I locate myself? And I'm lost again, you know. Yeah. So sometimes we are just in it and we don't know, and we're actually not sure. But I think the more you practice that, and the debriefing kind of helps with that too, which is sort of recognition. What was the context here? What were the conditions here? What led to the outcomes we saw?
Yeah, and what worked? I love that. I've never heard anybody talk about the debriefing process. And I think that's going to be really helpful to folks to practice, because I wish I had done it. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember holiday, my ex said that he wanted to go for one day to visit family. And it was like a 13-hour drive. And I'm like, I'm not going for a 13-hour drive to visit for one day. Yeah. And it was me and him and my daughter, and she finally was able to talk him into staying longer. But now, you know, I wonder if that was because, you know, he didn't want to engage in the small talk and the conversation. And at that time we were separated, but we were all going as a family. Okay. So he didn't want to have to deal with the emotions and the questions and whatever else. But instead of communicating that, he just said, I want to go for one day.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, if we had maybe debriefed, and that trip was a hellish trip. There were many fights on that 13-hour mm-hmm. drive. But if we had an opportunity to kind of debrief even before we got in the car, okay, why is it that you need this? Why is it that you want this? Whatever, we may have made that a more enjoyable trip. And then afterwards, if we had talked about, you know, what was comfortable, what was uncomfortable, what would you do differently in the future, that might have been really helpful for all of us. You know, my daughter was already an adult at that time. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, part of what gets me to get into agreement to the social needs of my wife is including, number one, sometimes open time, or having downtime and open time actually scheduled into whatever we're doing. And it's funny because my extended family has started doing this more, and it's probably, you know, probably more for me, you know, mm-hmm. but everyone sort of appreciates it too. You know, we're not overscheduled, we're not overplanned. And I tend to be able to work with that schedule a little bit better, but also my wife will often, you know, tempt me by using one of my deep interests. So, mm-hmm. you know, so on one of our anniversaries, we went to all of the covered bridges in Iowa, and we went travel around there, but she scheduled in disc golf for me. So on our way or in between, we were going to play around at disc golf someplace. And so to me, I'm like, I'm in.
I love that. So when
I'm included and I'm considered, and you know, I think everybody really wants to be seen, known, valued, and understood. And part of the problem with being neurodivergent is we often never felt that just naturally, you know, mm-hmm. just like we fit in here. This makes sense. This is intuitive for us, you know. Everything has felt alien and different and a fight and a struggle. And so when we are, it really creates also a lot of safety, but also allows us to find our own connection, our own voice, our own inclusion, which I think is so important.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, I know for a lot of couples that have been together for a while, you know, they've stopped going out on dates. You know, they don't seem to make time for socializing with other couples.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the things that I recommend is that they both make a list of 3 to 5 fun date nights for them. And they share those with their partner. And if anything is off the table, they can't include that for either partner. And then they put it in a, you know, a bowl. And they decide how often they're going to go out on a date. And then they pick from the bowl one of those date nights they've agreed to, so that neither one of them has to spend a long time thinking about that. They've already agreed to, you know, 6, 10, whatever different things. And the folks that have used that, I mean, it's not a new idea, have found it really helpful. Because there's that agreement ahead of time. They don't have to spend time going back and forth. What do you want? What do you want? What do you want?
Yes.
And they both feel respected and valued, which I think is really important.
Yes. I really like your mentioning of what do you want? What do you want? You do, because that is something I see with my couples so often is, you know, there's an awareness of the tension in the relationship and an unawareness of the internal perceptions and needs from each partner. You know, there's a little bit of a barrier there because of the different processing styles, the different wiring types. And a lot of times couples will get stuck with that, you know, and a lot of autistics have relational trauma. So, you know, I'm going to be second guessing why she's asking me that, or why she's offering that, or why that's an option. And is that about me? Is that what she really wants? And, you know, again, how do I locate myself? And, you know, again, suddenly I'm lost in the minutiae of expectations. And so that idea kind of solves that problem in a way, you know, and kind of puts it out there, creates some safety. Both sides have the input, and then hopefully
they can have a good date night and do it on a regular basis and, you know, build a different kind of relationship that is, you know, now because they understand each other's neurotype, the date nights are filled with, you know, happiness and laughter and good food or fun activities. Yeah. That they both know they'll enjoy. And I think agreeing to how long the date nights will be is also really critical because, you know, I could probably go on a 6-hour date night and the autistic men that I've dated, I'm not sure unless it was something they were really, really interested in. Yeah. I don't know that a 6-hour date night would have worked out well.
Yeah, it sounds exhausting already.
Yeah, I would have all kinds of things planned, right? Yeah, no spoons by the end of the night for the partner. Yeah. So I think this is a really great conversation. And for those folks that might be saying, well, what about, you know, if you have young children, we're going to do an episode on parenting and talk about that in a little bit more detail. But is there anything else you want to talk about related to family time with kids?
That's a good question. I mean, that's a whole nother layer. It's a whole nother layer of expectation. And, you know, I actually get a lot of clients coming in as they become new parents. Because as, you know, as your ex needed, right? Imagine you coming home from work and your work never stops.
Right.
The expectations, the demands, the needs around you never stop, you know. Again, it creates a lot of pressure. It's very difficult. So with kids definitely becomes more complicated. I think it becomes easier, at least I know it was easier for me to sort of defer to the kids, but you know, again, I often felt like, you know, and I'm guessing a lot of other autistics feel this way, a little bit like a kid. It's like, what about me? And, you know, in terms of my needs, and, you know, sometimes that can look a little bit narcissistic, but I think it's an important aspect of self-care and functioning, as a neurodivergent parent.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for family time, you know, if I could go back and change a few things, I would absolutely get input from my ex regarding dinners with my daughter's friends, you know, if he was up to it, how he felt about it. I would absolutely get his input on birthday parties. I know when he was growing up, his family didn't even have birthday parties. And I made sure we had a birthday party every single year for my daughter. I don't know if it was overwhelming for him. I don't know. We never discussed it. I loved it. I was in heaven, the whole planning process, you know, inviting all the kids, talking to all the families, you know, engaging in all the games, everything. I was in heven, but I'll bet it wasn't as enjoyable an experience for my ex. I don't know. So, you know, having that assigned role that fits with, you know, what your partner really enjoys, you know, maybe not having to have them be in charge of, you know, welcoming everybody, but, you know, feeling like you have a place in, you know, birthday parties with kids or family events, I think is really important. And respecting that if your partner needs an exit strategy, you know, how long do they need to be gone? Is it, you know, the rest of the time you're going to be there alone? And I don't know if you and your wife have ever done this, but texting, I can't come back, or I'm going to come back in an hour, I'm taking a walk, and having that kind of conversation either ahead of time. But I'm guessing if you're at a kid's birthday party or a family event and it becomes so overwhelming, you know, the sensory and the emotional overload, that you just need to exit for a little while, to be able to respectfully communicate with your partner would be really helpful.
Yes. We definitely have shot each other secret texts about our needs. And yeah, kids' birthday parties, not my favorite, particularly the younger, because if they're screaming, I am out. And the overstimulation is a thing too. You know, I, again, often would cook, you know, so I might be doing pizzas one at a time that kind of keep me busy, that keep me contributing kind of there. You know, sometimes, again, any role or structure can be helpful. So games or activities, stuff that we're doing can also be helpful. But yes, I know that one of the things that would really upset me is I would often be making the dinner, and then my wife would come to me and say, hey, you know, our child is wanting, hey, can these two people actually come over to, you know, or invited these people over to. And that change for me became, I just find a lot of anger and irritability. It's like to adjust to that, you know, and, you know, I feel like I know what I'm doing. I got it all planned. I have enough food. This is what it's going to look like. And then throwing that wrench into it for me was very difficult to kind of work with or switch with, you know. And I've learned to do it better, which is, I don't care. I'm doing the same thing. Whoever comes over is over. This is the food we have, you know. I mean, I've kind of gotten past it, but I really noticed that like jump up of irritability. And I know that my kids often wouldn't ask me, and my wife would sort of ask for them, because they were afraid probably of how I would respond, you know. And I'm not saying no, but they can see me getting, you know, kind of dysregulated, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, you know, you have this self-awareness, and you and your wife can plan things differently and communicate differently. And, you know, if I had a magic wand and could go back and redo all of those conflict situations around social events or family events or family vacations, oh my gosh, I would save us so much conflict and angst and, you know, judgmental attitudes and Mona screaming or Mona crying or, you know, my daughter running in her bedroom and slamming her door because she couldn't take it anymore. Yeah. So I hope this is helpful to folks. Do you have any last thoughts before we close out?
No, I just think this is a really important area. And I think if you can develop some habits and rituals, particularly around communication, you know, like we've talked about, and finding creative ways to support each other's different needs in those different ways, I think those are really big keys to, to better bridge those differences.
Yeah, I agree. And I love that you talked about at the beginning of our conversation about recovery, because I can tell you a lot of the couples that come to my support group, the autistic partners talk about, you know, they're willing to go and do the socializing, whether it's date nights or with family or friends or whatever, but then they may need hours or days of recovery time. And so to be aware of that, you know, and to talk to your partner about that and not take it personal. If your partner doesn't want to do an event or some kind of socializing every single night, five nights out of the week.
Oh, right. Yeah. And so, social burnout's a real thing. But even as I talk about, you know, your capacity, you know, if you're not attuned to the context of stress in each other's lives and the impact on it, you know, I may have had a hard, you know, week at work. And, you know, I don't be able to socialize at all. You know, I may have had a good week at work and I can do a lot over the weekend, you know, so it kind of depends on what the stress looks like, what your capacity is at, and all that stuff. You know, really good to continue open communication and renegotiation and keeping those lines open and developing awareness for each other. Helping cue each other, you know, again, because sometimes we're not aware, you know, so if that can be done safely and openly, things will work out much better.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I just want to tell the listeners that the next topic we'll be talking about in a few weeks will be cultivating positive feelings, affection, appreciation, and commitment in a neurodiverse relationship. So join us for that podcast. And Greg, I just love talking to you. And I'm really looking forward to all the other conversations we're going to have. And I'm going to put this out to the listeners that if there's a topic that you'd like Greg and I to talk about, feel free to email me at neurodiverselove4u@gmail.com. And I may even put this as a question in the podcast. And if there are other topics that we can address that will help couples out there, we would love to do it. So thank you so much, Greg. I look forward to our next conversation.
Same. Thank you so much, Mona. Great talking with you as always.